Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Okay, everyone, if you can come in now, find a seat if you can. We need to get started because if there's one thing that we really need to do with a festival with this many people is to try and keep it running to some sort of time. So welcome to this second session of Battle of Ideas 2023. This one's called The Politics of Hate. The Politics of Hate. Is that better?
Yes.
Is everyone a bigot but me? The partner for this, not inviting answers to that question. The partner for this session is Living Freedom, which is the initiative run by the Ideas Matter charity. I'm Alistair Donald, I'm the Associate Director at Academy of Ideas and the co-convener of this festival. Just in terms of trying to briefly situate this discussion, it is the case, I think, if you think back, even just as a few years ago, a decade ago, it was very much the case that Western societies, the UK as well, very much conceived of themselves as cosmopolitan, liberal and tolerant. And yet, if you think about the discussion in the last few years, then it seems a much darker view of society has emerged, that we're extreme, that we're hate-filled, and that it's quite hurtful in terms of what is spoken and discussed in many situations in society. So we want to look at this emergence of hate speech and hate more generally as an issue. Some say that there's been a massive increase in hate crime and hate speech. Others say that definitions of hate have expanded so much that it's inevitable that more things are caught up within those definitions. Others are worried about the way that hate has been weaponized as a means to silence people. So we want to just try and understand a little bit more about some of these developments, ask what are the prospects for making any sort of political exchanges a bit less toxic and a bit more productive? How should defenders of freedom and free speech make the case for free speech over hate speech? And how should we understand what really should count as hate speech? And this is all framed, I think, you'll agree and understand by the events of the last couple of weeks and a very intense discussion developed around what represents hateful remarks in the context of the situation in Israel and Palestine just now. So, okay, they might have to turn it up a little bit on the mixing desk or something like that. So let me introduce our panel. We have, and I'll say that in the order that they're going to speak. On my second from my left, and speaking first, is Faisal Sayed Al-Muttar, who's the founder and president of Ideas Beyond Borders, which is a non-profit dedicated to empowering people across the Middle East. Faisal was raised in Baghdad, and he's got a lot of familiarity, I think, with extremism and authoritarian regimes. So welcome to you, Faisal. Faisal's come over from New York for this event, so we're very pleased to have you here. Second, we'll hear from Winston Marshall on my far right. Winston is a musician, a writer. He's the hoster of one of the Spectator podcasts, Marshall Matters. He's a founding member of Mumford & Sons, and a co-founder of Hong Kong Link Up, a not-for-profit organization to assist Hong Kongers' integration into the UK. Then we'll hear from, on my immediate left, Martin Wright, who's director of Positive News, the media cooperative operating under the strapline Good Journalism About Good Stuff. Is that right?
That's right.
Formerly editor-in-chief of Green Futures and a former director of Forum for the Future, and someone who's spoken at Battle of the Ideas many times over the years, and it's very welcome to have you back, Martin, on this panel. It's a bit of a different panel for you because you usually speak on environmental issues. Then, on my immediate right, we'll have Kate Harris, who's a lifelong feminist and campaigner, co-founder of LGB Alliance, which held a very successful conference yesterday. I'm sure they were partying last night and there's a bit of recovering going on. But I'm sure she'll have lots of interesting things to say. Kate is a well-known activist, including in the corporate sector, actually, which is the thing that I wanted to mention. It was ironic, given that the corporate sector is where so much of the discussion around this issue happens. And finally, we'll hear from Eve Kay on my far left, who's a TV producer making television documentaries and factual entertainment, including for BBC, Channel 4, ITV, and most recently CNN. And Eve's a multiple award winner for the programmes that she makes. So can we give them all a very warm welcome, please? The format for this session is I've given them 5 minutes each to throw out some opening remarks, then I'm going to come straight out to you for all questions and comments and points that you want to make. We'll take a few in one go, come back to the panel and get a bit of a conversation going. So, Faisal, over to you first.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Do you guys hear me well? Awesome. Good morning. So, I guess good afternoon. I'm in jet lag, so I don't know which time zone I'm in. So, in 2004, I was watching, the internet was just introduced to Iraq. Back in 2003, before that, it was punishable by death in some occasions to have a radio station, to have a radio or listening to radio from the outside world, or have on satellite television. So, from my childhood, one of my first experiences was me and my dad go up at the rooftop, and my dad is holding a radio. And at 2 and 3 in the morning, we were able to hear what was being heard, was being broadcasted to us from neighboring countries. Maybe it was Kuwait. So I told my dad, like, why are we doing this at 2 a.m.? He said, because the government intercepts a lot of the signals during the afternoon, and it's really hard to listen to anything from the outside. We have to hide, because if people see us, we might actually suffer the consequences. So for me, the subject of censorship is something I grew up with. In fact, some of the stories is that my dad, that's, I would say, the Iraqi version of sex talk or sex ed talk is when my dad says, everything said in the house, don't say it outside, because some of your elementary school friends, their parents might be in the intelligence services, and we might all dead if you just tell us what their views are about Saddam Hussein. So back to 2004, I was, the internet was just being discovered, and I was watching a video that at the time the internet was pretty slow, and I saw that there was a video of the Iraqi tanks withdrawing from Kuwait, and it said that Iraq invaded Kuwait and Iraq lost the war with the Americans and stuff. And I was like, what Kuwait? This is not the story I was told growing up. I was told that America and Israel and the UK invaded Iraq and Iraq won that war. And then I went to my dad and I was like, how come I didn't know about this story that Iraq invaded Kuwait? I had no idea. So I thought that we were invaded and we fought back. And he said, if you know the truth, you would be dead. So for me, this subject of censorship is something very dear to my heart. And then when we kind of get to become after the withdrawal of the regime, and I'm sure every time I do a panel, I get asked a thousand questions about the Iraq war. But we went from one authoritarian to 1,000 authoritarians. Now, each sect, each group have their own militia, they have their own newspaper, etc. And really, we went, I guess, from 1984 to Brave New World, in which it's really hard to know what the truth is, because they can have a suicide bomber attack, and you can look at five news sources, and each one of them tell you that someone else has did the suicide attack. So in a way that we are now living in at least in Iraq, in which we live in a post-truth. The reason why I do care about this subject, especially when it comes to the West and my organization right now, even though most of our work is exclusively in the Middle East, is that the fact is that if America stops being free and if the West stops being free, where the hell would I go? Where would the people who actually care about those values I also say, like, when somebody says, what is the pitch for your work? I said, we fight for a freedom where the cost is death. So most of our work is actually working in closed societies and dictatorships. And for me, and what I see is, like, in many cases with dictatorships, I would say some of them what I would call the transitional dictatorships as we're seeing right now with kind of Turkey and other places that used to be not necessarily a beacon of freedom, but comparison to the region, they used to be free, is that they look at, to some extent, the hypocrisy of the West, and they look at the double standards of them trying to be claiming that they are free speech advocates, free speech defenders, but they see the censorship happening in campuses, and they see all of the other things that are happening. And then they tell their people in Turkey, in Algeria, in Egypt, they were like, do you see the West? This is, they're a bunch of hypocrites, and they are not in any sense or form what we need to be. We have to defend our Islamic values, our Asian values. And I think is that, I mean, when I came to America and I saw one of the first, kind of, I came in 2013 and 2014, I guess that's when censorship was going on steroids, is that I started being canceled left and right from university campuses, assuming on the idea that some of my talking points or so what I talk about might offend some of the students or minority students or majority students. And I look at that as like, okay, so like I grew up in Iraq, invaded by America, and the whole story of America was we're here to bring you liberty and bring you freedom and all of that stuff. And I come to the West and I start questioning whether this West is free at all, which I think is freedom of speech needs to be defended at all costs. To give you, I mean, now I have 1 minute, and I'm sure to save you the time of the questions that I might have about the Middle East, I think right now we are having one of our most difficult and worst weeks, I think, in Middle East history. And with no exaggeration, I'm expecting that the conflict will escalate regionally. I think that nobody is going to hold back. Everybody now, emotions and radical ideologies at their top. The dehumanization between both sides of the Arabs and the Israelis are at all-time high. So unfortunately, all of the work, all of the things that liberals and others have been fighting for in the Arab world, I think is now put into question. And it makes me really sad to see the region that I grew up with and the region that I visit frequently might not be in a worse place in coming days and coming years. And thank you very much. It's nice to meet you all.
Thanks, Faisal. Winston.
I shall attempt to answer the question, what counts for hate speech and its role in the British legal system. Last week was National Hate Crime Awareness Week, and one could say the most successful one to date. Starting 9 days after the October 7th massacre in Israel, when Hamas monsters butchered, slaughtered, torched and beheaded 1,400 Israelis and took 224 hostage, the streets of London were alive with anti-Semites and anti-Zionists chanting for jihad and genocide, many singing From the River to the Sea, and some even calling for the slaughter of the Yahud. London was a flood with hate, and thanks to social media, we all saw it. Obviously, this new awareness of hate is not something we're actually happy about, not just because it took a horrific tragedy to provoke, but because it seems, firstly, that anti-Semitic hate is endemic in many communities in the UK, but also that the British police and their adjacent quangos have done sweet diddly fuck all about it. Well, they managed 10 arrests out of 100,000 people. You, of course, will remember that the Humberside police visited Harry Miller for tweets such as, I was assigned mammal at birth, but my orientation is fish, don't misspecies me. Or when the West Midlands police had no trouble confronting Isabel Vaughan Spruce for silently praying. Or when the West Yorkshire police arrested a 16-year-old autistic girl for calling an officer a lesbian-like nana. Or the Merseyside police who arrested an 18-year-old girl with Asperger's for rapping a Snoop Dogg song on Instagram. Need I tell you about the tens of thousands of girls that have been habitually raped, trafficked and abused by grooming gangs up and down the country. Some of the girls were eventually murdered. Lucy Lowe, Becky Watson and Laura Wilson, for example, all of whom should be household names, but are not. Racist murders because they were white. And the police did not act because they themselves were too terrified to be labelled racist. In the 14-year history of the National Hate Crime Awareness Charity, these vilest of all hateful acts were never given attention. But I cannot conceive of a more hateful crime. Last week, during National Hate Crime Awareness Week, the police took the time to stop Campaign Against Anti-Semitism from screening pictures of Israeli hostages on the side of vans around central London. They took the time to stop people from waving England flags in England, I remind you. Meanwhile, extremist group Hizbut Tahrir were freely soapboxing for jihad, but the Met excused them, telling us they are varying interpretations of the language, what the language means. What does this all go to show? It shows that the word hate is an utterly redundant term when used in the British legal system. From the police to the court, hate only counts when the correct people are being hated if they hate deemed privileged, say they are white, If the hated are deemed privileged, say they are white, Jewish, or if it is Israel, then fill your boots with hate. But if the correct identity group is perceived to be the victim of this woolly word hate, then prepare to see the police kick into action. A brief history of hate in British law. This goes back to the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence in 93. In an attempt to prevent further such incidents, the concept of a hate crime was born. This evolved in two paths. The first path was through the Crime and Disorder Act 1998, which the Crown Prosecution Service is described as aiming at outlawing crime where offender is motivated by hostility or hatred. One asks why one would waste energy trying to outlaw what is already outlawed. Cemented later in the Sentencing Act 2020, where a seriousness of crime must consider racial, religious hostility or hostility related to disability, sexual orientation or transgender identity. The second path was through the beloved non-crime hate incidents. A non-crime hate incident means an incident or alleged incident which involves or is alleged to involve an act by a person which is perceived by a person other than that subject to be motivated wholly or partly by hostility or prejudice towards persons with a particular characteristic. 120,000 NCHIs were recorded in the last 5 years. If you have one on your record, you have no means of knowing, but any future employer does. The significance is that although perceived hate crimes can lead to arrest, they cannot be prosecuted without evidence. But an NCHI, on the other hand, does not need evidence. Met Police guidelines include incitement to hatred, defined as when someone acts in a way that is threatening and intended to stir up hatred in words, pictures, videos, music. Under this alone, there should have been hundreds of arrests at the pro-Palestine marches. Indeed, there are numerous surah in the Quran inciting hatred and actual violence against infidels and Jews. Under these laws, publishing the Quran in the UK is technically illegal, not that anything is going to be done about it. Our free speech is protected by Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights, but it is limited. Incitement to violence is illegal as per the Serious Crime Act 2007. The Terrorist Act 2010 makes criminal expressing an opinion or belief that is supportive of a proscribed organisation. This will rob, of course, with American First Amendment enthusiasts, but as we've seen this month, it really is not enforced. Being offensive is not, cannot, and should not be an offence, Harry Miller rightly told us. Something is either a crime or it is not a crime. The concept of hate adds nothing of advantage. All it has done, in practice, is follow the fault lines of political correctness, with police wasting their time and our money on what they can claim small victories for themselves. We need free speech, not only so bad ideas can be challenged with good ones, but as we have learned this month, so that we know exactly what people think. I hate anti-Semitism. I hate paedophilia. I hate injustice. I hate Chelsea Football Club. Hate is not always bad and does have some place in our lives. But hate in the legal system, in the British legal system, is token, pointless, and joined at the hip with political correctness.
Thank you.
There's quite a lot in there.
You can come back to some of that, I think. Martin, let's get your thoughts.
Thank you. Two phrases from my childhood. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words will never hurt you. If you want a nigger as a neighbour, vote Liberal or Labour. The first phrase was from my mum. When I came home complaining that the bullies at primary school had been taunting me, I didn't tell her that it didn't stop at taunting, they did things too, because I was ashamed. I didn't want her to know I hadn't stood up for myself. The second phrase was the campaign slogan which saw a Tory candidate, Peter Griffiths, incidentally a primary school head teacher, voted in as MP for Smethwick in 1964 against the national trend that year of a Labour landslide. I think it's a mark of how far we've come that even in a forum like this, which sanctifies free speech, I hesitated before using the N-word, such is its power to offend. So that's progress. Is it not something which was part of public discourse, albeit controversially, would now land the originator in court on incitement charges? He would see Peter Griffiths lose his seat and his job. And most people, I think, would agree that that wouldn't have been the most outrageous infringement on his free speech. And I'd hope a smart teacher now might spot what was going on at my primary school. Now, there is an argument we should only worry when words, hateful words, might lead to sticks and stones, or worse. And if that is all we have to worry about, we have some pretty basic laws in place. Winston referred to several of them. Conduct likely to cause a breach of the peace, incitement to violence, etc., etc. And yet it clearly doesn't stop there, or this would be a simple job in theory, albeit a nightmarish one in practice, jihad, anyone, to assess whether those words will indeed turn into sticks and stones. Now, leaving that aside, defenders of free speech, they make a lot of the fact that nobody has a right not to feel offended. And I agree. But arguably, every right also perhaps carries with it a responsibility. If living in a civilised society means anything, surely it means being vaguely sensitive to the people around you. That is surely page one, line one of How to Get Along. And it cuts both ways. I think there's a responsibility in all of us to stop for a moment when we hear something unpleasant and think before we reach for the outrage button, before we reach for the I find that so offensive switch. Now, one of the ways I think we can make progress on all this is not caricaturing the other, not demonising those people, particularly those we disagree with, those we compete with, not making them somehow less than human. Tory scum, worse than vermin, bunch of woke snowflakes. And not caricaturing their ideas or their policies either. So that's why I think it's pitiful that our politics increasingly seems to be dominated by caricature. Now, of course, there's room for contesting ideas and policies. But what we have increasingly is a kind of mindless adversarialism taking hold, a sort of identity politics, which is really just a posh phrase for vapid tribalism. A couple of tiny examples, and there are many more. You look at the way that, on one side of politics, complex arguments about how we share space between people and traffic on our streets has got reduced to the slogan of a war on the motorist, with that most unlikely of street fighters, Sir Ian Duncan Smith of the Party of Law and Order, celebrating vandals smashing up traffic cameras. On the other hand, we have Labour's finest spin doctors tackling the wicked problem of sentencing guidelines and reducing it to, do you think adults convicted of sexually assaulting children should go to prison? Rishi Sunak doesn't. Rather than debating issues, we're increasingly clashing soundbites. Once there was a speech, now there's a tweet. And I think this infects the way we define ourselves as well. We've got a determination almost to have less, not more, in common. Brexit v. Remain, environmentalist v. climate sceptic, motorist v. cyclist, Israel v. Palestine. It's like there's a weird kind of algorithm at work. Ah, so you voted Brexit, so you must be a climate sceptic, and you don't like you, Les, or Meghan. It's like we've been shoved into a giant sorting hat and we're all coming out as Montagues or Capulets. And that's a tragedy, because if you scratch the surface, most people aren't like that most of the time. Most people in their own lives are perfectly capable of seeing nuance, seeing complexity. So against that, this relentless adversarialism, this simplification of politics, this caricaturing of the other, feels like a bug, not a feature of what passes for debate or democracy. Most people, most of the time, aren't bigots and they aren't simple, and it's about time our political culture stopped treating us as though we were. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. And I think a number of things that I think we need to come back to in there. But let's hear from Kate first.
OK, let's just check. Can you hear me? Yes. I'm going to come at this as a possible case study, in the sense that I'm not really going to talk about any political theory, philosophical theory, legal theory about hate speech. I'm going to talk about LGB Alliance and how we were born, what happened next, and where we are now. If there are any students who wish to conduct a PhD, come and talk to me afterwards. I think our history is fascinating in terms of what's happening to dialogue in 2023. But let's turn the clock back to when we began. I think we were too slow. For anyone who doesn't know, we are the only charity in the United Kingdom who promotes the rights of lesbians, gays, and bisexuals exclusively. Every other charity that says that it has something to do with homosexuality, in fact, is the opposite, because it promotes what we know now as gender identity theory, which seeks to erase homosexuality. I can come on to that later if anybody's interested. So we started because I had been fighting all my life as a lesbian and a feminist for our rights to be heard, to be seen. I was extremely active in Stonewall, not working there, but as a corporate supporter, as Alistair mentioned. I worked at American Express, and I was able to raise significant amounts of money to sponsor some of Stonewall's key fundraising activities. I was a huge supporter of Stonewall when it was an organisation that fought for equality under the law, i.e. lesbians, gays and bisexuals have one thing in common, which is that we have the same sexual orientation. Apart from that, we're just exactly the same as everybody else. We don't require any additional rights. We don't require any change in language. We simply want to have all the rights and responsibilities of being a citizen of the United Kingdom. And that was what Stonewall was about once upon a time. In 2015, Stonewall came to a crossroads, having won all the battles, bar one tiny one about private pensions that we are tackling at the moment. But by and large, the battles were won. So we came to a crossroads. What do we do now as one of the most effective lobbying organisations in the UK? And many of us said, well, let's look around the world. There are 69 countries where homosexuality is still illegal. Most of these are in the Commonwealth. There's an awful lot of work to do to support our brothers and sisters worldwide. Ruth Hunt was to become the new chief executive officer. I even supported her in that. I mea culpa. And I have expressed to her several times since my regret at my support. She promised us, particularly me, as a lesbian who was encouraging other lesbians to support her to become chief exec, she promised us she would do nothing to add the T to LGB. She broke her word, and in 2015, Stonewall and every other charity that follows its model became TQIA+. So at that point, being kind, being civilized, adopting the values of the liberal enlightenment, we tried to talk. We tried to talk respectfully. It didn't work, and I wasted probably 3 years of my life gathering people together because we were so keen to get a dialogue going. We didn't see what was so obvious, that they hated us. They hated the fact that we put a spoke in their wheel of their stupid idea that there is such a thing as an LGBTQIA+ community, that they had no intention of speaking to us ever, and they haven't ever. So after 3 years of trying through a series of letters, offers to meet with the current trustees, old trustees, we tried every kind of peace talks imaginable, short of getting the UN to assist. And when that came to nothing, we formed LGB Alliance. I met Beverly Jackson, who's sitting in the front row at the moment. I was introduced to her in the spring of 2019. She was a founding member of Gay Liberation Front long before Peter Tatchell arrived in this country. I met Bev, and between us, we decided that action was needed and no one else was coming forward. We'd have to do it. We did it in 6 months. We gathered together a group for our first meeting. Alison Bailey, who many of you know, came to our first meeting at the Conway Hall. And at 1 minute to midnight on the 22nd of October 2019, Alison Bailey tweeted to the world, "Watch out, world, LGB Alliance is here, and you gender identity theorists, look out." Within a couple of minutes, we were branded a hate group, and I'll talk more about that later. Thank you.
It would be good to come back to that and see how the hate discussion has framed some of the way that LGB Alliance has situated itself and conducted itself. But let's hear from Eve finally.
I would like to start with some good news.
Yay!
Which is that despite the public discussion, actual hate in Britain is falling and not increasing. In the general population since the 1990s, we've actually had an outbreak of civility rather than an increase in hate. There's been a 72% decrease in violent crime against all people since 1995. And it's not just general hate and violence that's fallen. It's also a specifically hate and violence against minorities that's fallen. Racially aggravated assaults have decreased from 4,711 convictions in 2001 to 800 convictions in 2018. Racially aggravated wounding has fallen from 3,176 convictions in 2001 to just 10 convictions in 2018. So just as actual racist crimes and all violent crime against people have fallen, strangely, the concept of hate crime has risen steeply. I draw your attention to this because hate speech theory tells us that hateful speech creates a climate that induces violence. Yet we have not seen violence in the general population in the last 20 years. So how do we account for the rise in hate crime convictions that other people have mentioned, hate crime speech convictions particularly? Despite this fall in actual violence against persons, the concept of hate crime has expanded legally and institutionally, as Winston, I think, mentioned at the beginning, where in 2007 there was a redefinition of hate crime by the police and by state agencies to include this idea of the perception of an offence by victims and witnesses. But I think the most important point here is that it could only be expanded institutionally because it reflects a new reality for many people. And by that I mean that in public discussions, our tolerance for disagreement and our robustness and our capacity to take criticism or nuance has collapsed. There are 1,000 examples of this that I'm sure you can all think of, but one of the kind of recent grotesque examples that comes to mind is the case of Roisin Murphy, the Irish singer-songwriter, who only had to say that she thought that puberty blockers were unsafe and that gender-confused kids were vulnerable, to be accused of transphobia and cancelled as an artist. So her expression of sympathy for distressed young people being potentially exploited by Big Pharma was read as hatred towards transgender people. Similarly, we saw during Brexit that to Remainers, Brexit was simply an expression of hatred against foreigners, even though there are now more migrants living peacefully in the UK than at any other time in recorded history. If we are reading hate into every disagreeable encounter, perhaps it's because we believe ourselves to be hateful. And if we're guilty of harbouring hate, then perhaps other people are also guilty of harbouring it. How did this disposition to take offence and experience every disagreement as hateful arise? Over the last 20 years, there's been a loss of belief in what Britain and the West stands for. The West is in the dock for the crime of imperialism and racism. And Western elites no longer gain their legitimacy from being defenders of freedom and democracy. The enemy that we face is no longer other countries, other systems, Islam, communism. The threat to us is no longer external, it's internal. The threat that Western elites now organise themselves around is ordinary people and their hateful inner lives. And it's this alleged inner hate which is the basis of a new moral claim that Western elites are now making to legitimise their rule over us. the old Western values of democracy and freedom are no longer the foundation of human emancipation, but they're now just Trojan horses for allowing white people to be hateful to minorities. And I think it's this pervasive cultural pessimism and this kind of Western self-loathing that in part helps explain the massive increase in anti-Semitism that we have seen in the last few weeks. In our imaginations, Jews have become the worst of the West. They are the white settlers bombing Palestinian victims. And because they are white, and because they are rich, and because they are colonizers, it's okay to loathe them. In fact, not only is it okay to loathe them, it's righteous to loathe them. And the gruesome slaughter of their innocents can be celebrated on the streets of Britain. Just to finish off, I want to say that banning hateful words, including anti-Semitism, which I think is on the rise and goes against this general trend, downward trend on violence, will not eradicate hate, because hate doesn't spring from the words themselves. Fear and hate come from the underlying trends and impulses and social drives in society. In fact, not only will banning hateful speech not stop anti-Semitism or any other form of hatred, it will make anti-Semitism worse, because it's not going to help us clarify the issues in the public square. And instead, it will doom us to perpetual suspicion, division, more fear and more hate.
So, last point, Eve.
Last point. So just summing up, in the case of anti-Semitism, we should not be joining the clampdown on speech, even if it's anti-Semitic, even if it feels risky, because it will make anti-Semitism worse. It's not going to make it better.
Okay, thanks to you all. Lots of points in there. I'm going to come straight out to the audience, actually, and grab a bunch of questions and then come back to you for some comments. So let's... really difficult to see. Who has the microphones? So just there's one. Let's go there first. Where's the other microphone? Oh, God. Yes, OK. On you go.
I've been saying the same thing at Battle of Ideas for... Sorry. I've been saying the same thing at Battle of Ideas for about 10 years now. The hate that we're imagining to express is purely and simply a projection by the elites onto us. And the history, and there's lots of books, a slew of books coming out the last 2 or 3 years, all explaining this. The history is 100 years old. The problem was is that Marxist intellectuals couldn't understand why the Western proletariat in advanced capitalist states wasn't revolting, whereas their Ruski cousins, being peasants more or less, were. Arby thought it's repression, in a non-scientific Freudian way. Capitalism, as if it's psychogenic, which it isn't, has repressed the male workers, and in turn they repressed their women and children. This is the origin of contemporary feminism. This was run with by intellectuals who went to the University of America, melded with ideas of postmodernism. Then you had Marcuse. We got the idea that that's a combination of Marxist intellectuals and the ghetto. To
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
I'm making a point. You're allowed to make a point. We don't have
thank
to
you. Could you pass the microphone to that guy there in the black? And is there someone upstairs? Yes. I'll come to upstairs next.
I've got two questions, really. My first is hate speech, and I think this links well to kind of some of what Winston was saying earlier, is that it's so subjective. Some of the same people who think adult human female is hate speech and colourblindness is racism have no problem defending angry mobs chanting gas at the Jews. How far would you agree, and this is my first question, it's an open question to everyone, that if everything is hate, nothing is? My second question links a bit more to this idea, and I think it links to something Kate was saying about how political debate has been poisoned and made more intolerant. And I think a lot of this comes down to identity politics. We've kind of elevated identity to almost a religious belief, an incredibly selfish, almost totalitarian religious belief at times. The one thing we're constantly told matters is not who we are, but what we are, our sexuality, our gender, our race, etc. And those we disagree with in those circumstances cease to be our political opponents and become kind of enemies of our religion of the self. My question there is, how can we depersonalise politics so it becomes less about identity and irrelevant box-ticking of things like the colour of our skin and more on the common good?
OK, useful. Thank you very much. So there's someone up at the top, I think. I can't see anything up there. So
questions to the whole panel, but largely to Kate. Firstly, I've got to say I think your organisation is amazing. I just wanted to ask about whether you think that the biggest homophobes in the country are actually the people that push this trans right narrative. Whether you feel that it is undoing all the work that organisations such as yourselves, such as Stonewall before they did change, have done to say that, look, being gay is not a choice. This is something you're born with. This is how you're going to live your life. And it's meant to be all about embracing that. And now what we've got is a movement that's saying, actually, you can choose to be whatever you want to be. As far as I see it, it's completely undoing the movement and everything it stood for. And I'm a big believer that the cultural left has this sort of pyramid system of sort of minorities. And the higher up in the pyramid you are, you can undo everything that people lower down the pyramid have. So to you, in your work, do you find that it is actually the trans rights movement that causes you the most trouble, that pushes back on the fight to show people that being gay is not a choice? And how dangerous is it if the mainstream consensus in politics that I have embraced this, as I think they have, and what can we do to fight back against that?
OK, I've got one down here. Then if you can find another hand upstairs, we'll take that, and then I'll come back to you for some quick comments. So, yes.
I just wanted to talk about a recent experience I had at Let Women Speak in Liverpool. I was stewarding and speaking as well from Thoughtful Therapists, and it was astonishing watching just the utter mindless, and it wasn't just hatred, it was utter contempt, almost hating would have been that it mattered, but the contempt for us was just extraordinary. So I just wanted to say something about that, and there was no listening. It was extraordinary. There was a woman talking about her family surviving the Holocaust, and she was booed, and someone was talking about it. It was exhausting. It was exhausting.
Okay, and if you can just pass it back to the guy in the blue, and then I'll come back to the panel.
Hi, I wish we could learn to listen to each other's stories more. And I feel there's a lot of polarisation. Already on the panel, the word anti-Semitic has been used a couple of times. I am very pro-Palestinian. And the problem with being pro-Palestinian is that other people do interpret that as being anti-Semitic. I totally believe in equality for everyone who calls the Holy Lands home. But I'm not sure in the mainstream media or even on this panel, just because I'm into equality and support one side and support equality, it disturbs me that that comes across as potentially anti-Semitic. And I guess one great example would be Jeremy Corbyn, who's the least anti-Semitic person out there in my view. He stands up for everybody, Jewish and Palestinian, in the Holy Lands, and yet he's got his own story.
Okay. We'll come back out again, so don't worry. I'll bring lots of people in, so just keep your hands up when I come back out again. But let me come back to the panel for some answers. I mean, Winston, should we start with you? I mean, given the question down at the front there, I suppose the thing that comes to mind in terms of what you said was, are you just being a little bit dismissive of the problem of hate speech? So, for example, if you looked at the situation in New York the other day where the people were battering on the windows outside in that gallery shop in that museum, uttering all sorts of anti-Semitic slogans, basically wanting to batter the doors down or whatever, is that not, you know, does that worry you? And if so, how does that worry relate to the hate speech conversation?
My worry about that specific incident is very deep, because the images we're seeing from campuses across America, look, let's put it this way. All my life, we've said never again, never forget. Yeah. But it seems to me that we never actually worked out what it is we weren't supposed to forget. And so there's, we've got this history of World War II, and maybe a low-definition version is oh, no more nationalism. That was the problem. But it seems to me, actually, no. The deeper problem is, and it's, I mean, maybe it's too much for right now, but it's something to do with people being perceived as oppressors if they're, some of them are more successful. So this would apply for the Tutsis versus the Hutus, the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. It would apply for the Jews in Germany. It even applies how the Bolsheviks saw Russian society. They misperceive one group as being oppressors just because they are, in some metrics, more successful. That seems to me to the lesson that we haven't learned, and I think that that applies to what we're seeing in Israel at the moment to some degree. It's obviously more complicated than that. I don't assume this gentleman is an anti-Semite, because you're pro-Palestine. I would like to see a Palestinian state, and in that sense, I am pro-Palestinian. I would also like there to be an Israeli state, so I don't make that assumption of you. One other point I want to make was the first question, I think, one of the first questions about the idea of if everything is hate, then nothing is hate. And this also applies to words like fascist or Nazi. It's used so often now that my kick reaction is when someone is described as that is to assume that they're not that. Those words have lost complete meaning. They've been gutted of anything substantial. That even hate now, I just assume. Like with LGB Alliance, when I first came across them and they're described as a hate group, I assume, well, then they're not hate group. And I immediately was interested because they must be doing something right, because I can see who's calling them a hate group.
Okay. Faisal, yes.
Yeah, I mean, hate exists. I mean, I grew up in a civil war, and I've seen the level in which, I mean, it starts first with basic polarization, and then the spectrum leads to dehumanization, and then when you reach that level, really, wars start make no meaning. And to give you some recent experience, in 2015, President Obama called on the U.S. tech companies, Google, et cetera, to try to deal with the recruitment of ISIS on the internet. And I was recruited, not by ISIS, but by the tech companies, to actually try to understand the situation. And there was one video that really, I would say, kept me awake at night for at least 6-7 nights, was a video of a taxi driver in Belgium. He's from a Moroccan origin. And the video was directed towards kind of Muslims who live in the West, and also kind of to some extent Westerns who live in Gulf states. And it was, hi, I'm a taxi driver. I was born in Belgium, but my life is shit. And this is what we're always going to be. We're going to be treated like crap. I'm brown. There's now a caliphate, and there's this Islamic state. Let's all fly to Syria. And then through data analysis, we actually saw that many of the people who watched that video were searching on the internet how they can join ISIS. So there is definitely a correlation between wars and violence. And there's a correlation between wars and recruitment. That's why Russia today spends billions of dollars from Arabic to, and where my work is, to Pakistan, to all these places that try to spread Russian propaganda and to try to move. One of the studies being done on Russia today is that they spend a lot of money to try to deny that Assad used chemical attacks in Syria, and it's been one of the most successful disinformation campaigns in the world by changing the minds of tens of millions of people in the Arab world that actually it was America that did the chemical attacks, not Russia. So the question is how we deal with it. And the thing is, like, that there is one solution is to do more social engineering, in which some of the companies, tech companies, try to spend money to recruit people to move on the other side. There is a great research called the redirect method, which I recommend everybody to read, that has tried to kind of create a counter narrative against that. And there is censorship, and we have tried pretty much all of them, and nothing seems to work. So, in fact, that seems to be something that is open, is that hate is real, in my opinion, but I really don't know. I don't think anybody knows how to deal with it.
Kate, any thoughts? I mean,
yes.
For you, I always think back to the incident of a little while back, punch a turf.
And you know, this is this thing that Faisal's talking about the relationship between words and violence. But that seems to be a fairly clear case of incitement to me, and perhaps not hate speech. So I just wondered how you, in your situation, differentiate between these things. Because I think it's, you as an organisation might be in an awkward position because you wouldn't like that punch a turf sentiment, but at the same time, you yourselves are accused of hateful actions and speech by others. So kind of how do you work that through in your own mind?
I'm going to respond to that with three short answers. just very, very quickly, hate is a weapon. The word hate and calling people a hate group is a weapon. It is incredibly energy draining to be named a hate group, which is why we were named a hate group within minutes of landing on this planet. What it actually meant was that we don't know what you're talking about because you haven't written or published anything yet, but you've dropped the T. And therefore, you have ripped up our stupid script that there is such a thing as a QTI, LGBTQIA plus community, so we don't like you, we hate you. Now, as you can see, that isn't a terribly intellectual exercise, because when we were named a hate group, we had no mission statement, we had published not a single tweet, not a single article, we didn't exist, but we had put a spoke in the wheel of this ludicrous ideology. So fundamentally, how do we cope with it? It is a refusal to engage in dialogue, because when we did start and we did put out publications, we did try to get our message across. Not one person on Twitter, I can promise you, and Bev actually did our tweets for, I think, 2 years daily, not one person has ever challenged us on our key goals, which are freedom of speech, stop the medicalization of children, and promote the rights of people who are same-sex attracted. It's pretty vanilla stuff. So we have never engaged in anything hateful, but because they have no argument, they say you are hateful. If any of you have a spare moment on a rainy Sunday, I encourage you to go to our website. We've got the transcripts of our trial there, which were deemed so amusing by an American playwright that he's actually turned it into a play. But you can see that on our side, we had done our homework, our answers were detailed, they were referenced. The opposition had nothing to say. Very briefly, I'm just going to answer the bloke in the balcony who said, "How dangerous are the trans rights activists in the mainstream?" They're extremely dangerous. And equally dangerous are their queer allies, who are usually heterosexual couples, where one of them dyes their hair. We have launched a new campaign specifically to split LGB and to let the QTIA plus people do their own thing. We're going to be launching that this week. And just before you stop me, somebody here said, listen to each other. Now, there's a problem with that. You can't listen to what LGB Alliance says if we're not on any single mainstream channel ever. And that has been the case since we began. We've engaged with the BBC, with Sky, with ITN. The only channel that will allow us to speak, thank you, is GB News.
Who happen to be in this room and filming later in the day. Martin, anything that you want to pick up on? But I suppose a question to you is this, the way that Kate is talking about hate being weaponized makes the point that was raised over there about how you depersonalize all of this stuff much more difficult. Makes it much more complicated.
And you try to destroy the individuals who are just doing a very reasonable job.
Yeah, Martin.
Not easy. Avoiding caricature at all times is going to get tougher. Crowds of people in London chanting "Gas the Jews," really?
More of Sydney.
Okay. Avoiding caricature is going to get harder. It's going to get harder with AI, with deep fake videos. It is going to be incredibly easy to paint your opponents saying whatever you want them to say. We already know it in terms of audio. It's going to become so in terms of video. You're not going to be able to believe what anyone is saying unless you're sat in a room with them. So the tendency to increasingly cheapen our politics by resorting to caricature is going to grow. There's going to be a danger of a vicious spiral of this stuff, an arms race. You're already seeing it in the most sort of almost frivolous ways compared to some of the stuff we've been talking about so far, where you've got, you know, I referred to that pathetic Labour attack ad about Rishi Sunak not wanting sex offenders to go to prison, and you've got equally ludicrous things, the Conservatives saying under the Tories you will never have to have seven bins for recycling in your kitchen. Nobody has seven bins for recycling in your kitchen. Nobody is proposing that, you know. It's only a step from there, sort of under the Tories. You will never have to sell your firstborn to the devil. I mean, it's going to get worse, this kind of caricature. And it is down to all
of
us.
Well, I'm more interested in how you resolve it.
Christ, you resolve it partly by all of us stepping up, taking responsibilities as adult, sophisticated human beings to not fall into the trap of demonising people, to recognise that a lot of problems are really, really wicked problems. And there is not a simple, easy solution to them which involves putting other people down. Now, education is obviously going to be a huge part of that. I'm happy to give a shout out to the Academy of Ideas for their Debating Matters competition, which I've been involved with, which is tremendous in terms of encouraging children to debate, especially debating positions they don't even hold themselves. So we need to do a lot better on that. But it comes down to each of us in the here and now. Each of us has the power not to fall into this mindless tribal adversarialism.
Eve, pick up on anything you want, but you might want to respond to some of that.
Yeah, I also wanted to pick up on the how to depersonalise politics. I had a recent experience as a signatory of the Westminster Declaration, and I was trying to reach out to some left-wing friends of mine in television to encourage them to sign it as well. And I reached out to this one guy who's a TV producer, and he got back to me and said that he wasn't going to sign the Westminster Declaration, even though he was also against censorship, because Toby Young was also a signatory, which to me was kind of like the worst example of how people personalise political issues. I mean, I used to hate Toby Young when, you know, I was a lefty in the 80s and Toby Young was this right-wing young Turk. But do you know what? I don't care where Toby Young came from anymore, because we have to get away from, you know, people's personal, you know, what schools they sent their kids to, what associates they used to hang out with, get away from the identity group that people are in, and we have to start talking about the issues of free speech, the issues of whatever, and focus on that and get together with people who are going to fight for those things, no matter where they came from.
OK, Eve, I'm going to stop you there, because we've got a huge number of hands. Can I just ask, if there's no one upstairs that wants to speak, can the other microphone come down here? Someone's got the microphone there. Yes.
Hi. Joanna Cherry, Member of Parliament for Edinburgh South West. I'm actually, I wanted to ask a legal question, but I just wanted to make a comment first. Winston, I'm glad what you said, about what it is we need to remember. I'm glad you said what you said about the Palestinians' rights. Because what it is we forgot and what we need to remember is that genocide is wrong, no matter whom a genocide is perpetrated against, whether they be a Bosnian Muslim, a Jew, or a Palestinian. And I think that's something that perhaps needs to be said in this hall this morning. But what I really want to talk about is the law. Again, Winston, there's no such thing as a British legal system. I would say that as a member of the Scottish Bar. There's a Scottish legal system and an English and Welsh one. But what we all have in common is we're, at the moment, still all members of the European Convention on Human Rights. And under Article 10, there's a very high level of protection for free speech, particularly when it's criticism of politicians and discussion of political ideas. And I know this because I've successfully represented a woman in Scotland who's charged with hate speech and got the Crown to drop the charges on that basis. So what can we do, all of us who believe in free speech, to make sure that the law is properly enforced across the United Kingdom? And also, what do we do about the problem of these activist police officers? You know, these are, there's so many activists in the police now who are perpetrating a particular ideology. So that's really my question. How can we use the law better to protect free speech, and what do we do about activist police officers? Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. So that microphone goes up that way, and there's someone up top got the other one. Yes.
I was interested in the educational solutions to the problem, and I wondered if anyone agrees that critical thinking is taught to people in schools and universities to criticise people outside of themselves, to criticise institutions, to criticise other, to think critically about other people's points of view, but push your own point of view, and not to think carefully about your own point of view first, and to consider that critically rather than anything that's in opposition to your point of view.
Okay, thank you. There's someone with the microphone there. If there's no one upstairs else, then bring it down. Yes, thanks.
Actually, the gentleman just now is going to follow up on both of his points, both of mine. I'm a home educator of nearly 10 years, three children, and I think one of the most important things we can do is teach our kids how to think, not what to think. So in my house, no ideas off the table, everything's on the table, and I will give airtime to anybody as long as they're polite and they're nice. And I think the biggest problem in society now is that we're either singing to the choir or we're fighting in the street against each other. I mean, I spent nearly 10 years blogging and writing. I had a very dysfunctional childhood, dragged myself out of the quagmire, and wrote a book about breaking the cycle of dysfunction. Because it all starts when we're kids. And unfortunately, why so many people end up filled with hatred is because of their own childhood. And there's just not enough opportunities for a lot of people as they're growing up and as they're becoming young adults. So, like, I think that is the battleground. It's like, you know, my kids are lucky. They've got me and my husband at home. We're both very invested in their education and their upbringing. A lot of people aren't that lucky. So how do we help, as a society, create opportunities for everybody so we can all just have polite conversations, hear each other, and actually take the other...
Okay. If you could pass it to the guy behind you. Meanwhile, there's someone upstairs. Yes.
Checking on the law question, two thoughts or questions. One, if a society is governed by laws that are enacted by duly elected legislatures, then to not enforce the law is really truly to violate one of the key tenets of society. And it troubles the second aspect of free speech in the law is that, at least in the United States where I come from, it is illegal to incite violence to speech. And that is a law. And there's a difference between saying things that are hateful but inciting violence.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
As far as the law goes, I think it should be set where it's got to be pretty extreme for the law to step in. Because I think we would hope that we could manage our interactions civilly through telling people I don't agree with you or that's obnoxious or what have you. So I really think that, the guy makes the point just at the back there. Incite violence, I think in British legal system, English legal system, against a person, it's got to be quite specific. You know, you can't, if you say, death to everybody, you can't be prosecuted for that because it's too non-specific. But I also think that we should not be too pious about caricaturing other people and denigrating arguments. I'm not saying that these are good, but I'm just saying that, you know, we're human, not angels, and the way that we come to the truth is not that we know it already. It's we try stupid arguments out and then we finesse them. And we realise in the early burning that other people have maybe got a point. So we should certainly aspire to be good interlocutors, but we need to understand that the kind of very aggressive argumentative style, which can spin out of control. It's because people are trying to reconcile difficult things, and that arguments often seem a bit mental. But we would hope that the weight, the civil weight of reason, would outweigh the stupidity. And that seems slow coming, but that's where we should be.
Okay, thanks. If that one goes to the guy over there, and there's someone upstairs, I think, got a
quick question.
Just wait for the upstairs person, sorry.
Okay, so.
Yes, go on.
I personally was in Palestine 2 months ago, or just under 2 months ago, and I want to say how what the media portrays of what is going on isn't exactly 100% accurate. Because what I saw and experienced firsthand, I was interrogated by Israeli officers on a daily basis just because I look Arab and I'm a hijabi. And so I'm not saying, yes, go Hamas, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is any death can't be justified, and that in this case of Palestine versus Israel, what's happening isn't right, neither for the Palestinians, nor for the Jews or the Israelis who are being killed. And so I just want this to stop, and I want people to actually understand that what's going on in Palestine isn't what is portrayed in the media, which is that Palestinians are the ones in the wrong, whereas it's more the Israelis who are actually harming
okay.
Palestine.
Thank you. So there's one down there, and I think there's one more still up there. Yes, okay.
Hi, up the road from where we are right now, this group of people chanting from London to Gaza will have Antifada right now. Should they be arrested, yes or no?
Yes, so it's a good question, I think someone should come back and answer that. I'm just going to keep going. We've got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to keep going with a few questions and then give you a decent amount of time to come in at the end and just answer a few of these questions. So, yes, upstairs.
So, in many debates in the media, well, basically in all debates in the media, there's always two complete extremes. There's never really a common ground in between these two, and this kind of promotes extremism. For example, in the BBC, there's always, like, completely different people with radical opinions. And this kind of, it promotes extremism, and many young people have really extreme ideologies because extremism is the ultimate expression of agreeableness in our age, like in our radical age. So how can we try to remove this constant radicalization in the media, especially when it's widespread, such as the BBC?
Yes, okay.
I've got a question for the whole panel. Actually.
Yes, that's fine.
I'm here from Australia, so that gentleman is wrong. But it's the press. Bad news sells. Here were a few demonstrations. They got a lot of press. People beat it up, and it became sensationalised. Sensation.
Hang on.
And what I think in hate speech, and I'd like your comment, is a lot of hate speech is beaten up by the media because it sells newspapers or television shows. So we're looking at the law. But why don't we impose responsibility on the BBC or whoever it happens to be, report the facts, not what they would like the facts to be, but what actually happened. There were a few people in Sydney, not hundreds, and they were whipped up in all the press and all the photographs. The same with our election, which is the voice debate. It was nearly 70% of the population who voted no. And now we're all bigots. No, I'm a lawyer, it's a constitutional issue. They're not bigots. They just thought differently from the twittering classes. But the press beat it up. So where in the hate speech debate does the press come in? That's my question.
Okay, so that's one for someone to pick up. There's one woman over there in the blue shirt who's had a hand up all since we came in here almost. One person upstairs.
I come from I'm in the creative industries. What happened for the last 30 years. I'm an actor and a writer, and play, bands and stuff like that. And the last 5 years have been the worst I have ever, ever known. I was on a set the other day, and I was talking to someone who was, like, really young, about 25, 26, and I'm a lot older. And I'm talking about J.K. Rowling, right? I'll just bring up the subject of J.K. Rowling, which on any film set is like the Ebola virus, you know? So I'm just talking to this person, fellow actor, and she looked around. It's empty. Where I was talking to her was an empty space. We were outside in the car park. And she looked around before she spoke to me. And I looked at her and I said, what are you looking around for? You know? And she said, and she looked at me with virtual fear in her eye. I mean, as an actor, I can suss out fear when I can see it, you know what I mean? And I looked at her and I said, you shouldn't be doing this. Why are you so scared? And she said, well, if I said this on the films, if I said this inside there, I'd never work again. That's insane, right? That's completely mad. I mean, J.K. Rowling said
nothing. Can you just make the point quickly? Because we're really running out of time.
I'm an actor, aren't I? So I've got to go. I need the lines. How do we stop that?
Okay. That was a quick finish. Right, final question.
Very quick.
Hang on.
Okay.
Right.
Now, the one way we seem to be dealing with this alleged hate is to impose some kind of formal, informal, no debate clause. Is there any constructive way we can do this, either in a social circle or a workplace, and should we?
Okay, and the very, very final contribution before I take my panel back in just to give a few final thoughts and pick up on some of these questions is just the woman there on the edge who's also had her hand up the entire time we've been in here.
Thank you. I'm going to keep it really short. Is there actually also a case for sometimes shutting the fuck up and listening?
All right, short but sharp. Where shall we start? Faisal. These are your final remarks, by the way, so just kind of leave us something to think about as well.
Sure. In our organization, we have always had this motto that critical thinking is the best vaccine against misinformation, disinformation. We have done significant, actually, campaigns that are trying to reach multiple audiences all across the Middle East and North Africa. Teaching people about confirmation bias and logical fallacies and things like that. That being said, while I'm a champion, I would say, of critical thinking, what the data, The Economist did a very good article about the fact that fact-checking actually doesn't work. Most people are more motivated by emotion than motivated by facts. And that's actually a significant reason of why the kind of the social media algorithms or even the media algorithms try to drive people towards emotional thinking than what's real. And that has always been a major challenge. I think there have been some research being done, and that's something that we would like to do, engage more in, is that how to make critical thinking sexy and how to make it emotionally resonating with people. So they're really trying to use the system against itself, is that now when people are more driven by tribalism, they're driven by emotion and religious ideology, how can you move them towards reason? And there's been all of these attempts, I think, that has been championed by people like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, all of that stuff, which I think we have known acknowledged that has failed. So the thing is that can we find a way in which we can make critical thinking sexy? And I think that is a significant part of the solution. And in terms of how can we deal with Fatah and Intifada, I think we're now at the moment where I think that violence is only going to escalate. So I think it's not going to be no peaceful solution for what's happening.
Okay. Be sessions that discuss that later on, I can tell you. Winston, just do you want to pick up on anything? I mean, you might want to deal with the arrests question, given the very direct nature of it.
A lot of this, whether it's the question of hate or the word intifada, a lot of it is semantic. So these aren't... I don't find them that easy to answer myself. Although one word which is very important on semantically being used, as the Right Honourable MP used, was the word genocide. And I would be very careful using the word genocide. It is not a genocide if you have your country invaded and then you try and eliminate the attacker and there are civilian casualties as a process of war. That is not genocide. Let's be very careful on semantics.
I chose my words carefully.
Okay. Kate, pick up on anything you want,
I'm
but just kind of weave it into a final thought.
It's very, very, very quick. For the actor, I have no idea. It is something that it's extremely concerning. There's a new organisation called Freedom in the Arts. Please speak to Rosie Kay and Denise Farmy, who's just won a case against Arts Council England. We've got to make progress in the arts. Secondly, somebody said perhaps we don't need to invoke the law quite as often as we do. We do. That's all we have. And I'll tell you why. As LGB Alliance, since the day we started, we've had attempts to close down our websites, to close down our Twitter feed, to intimidate us, to imitate us, to post pictures of me and my chair of trustees wearing Nazi armbands, to try to stop our funding, to kill us at birth. It didn't work, so what did the opposition do? They took us to court to try to have our charitable status removed. As far as I'm concerned, the law is about the only protection we have left. So please go and support our fund, because it cost us £250,000 and we've still got £50,000 outstanding, simply to say that there is a place for an LGB charity in the United Kingdom. Very briefly, the press, from Pink News to the BBC to Reuters, they lie about us because we disrupt the narrative that has become so dominant. And finally, what do we all have to do? We have to follow the example of the wonderful Magdalene Burns, lesbian activist, one of the funniest people you can ever meet. She died, but she's on YouTube. Watch her videos. And she says, it's not hateful to speak the truth. So keep speaking the truth.
Martin, you say pick up on what you want, but it does seem to me that there's a kind of outstanding issue on the law and the legal side of things that we've not quite managed to tackle. I mean, it's been interesting the last week the way that on some levels the law has been blamed as inadequate by the police after Braverman criticised the police for not acting. I mean, is everybody just wriggling out of responsibility here? Or is the law already we need?
People always wriggle out responsibility, that's for sure. It's very, very difficult. Part of the reason we have laws is to indicate as a society what sort of direction we want to travel in, not necessarily because we expect them to be enforced every second of the day. Words do precede actions. Winston referred to the Rwandan genocide, which I think you can correctly call that a genocide in Rwanda. Yeah. It was worked up for many weeks leading up to it with Tutsi radio stations condemning the Hutus as cockroaches. The venerable Katie Hopkins referred to the people trying to cross the channel in small boats as cockroaches, and I hope she was unaware of the precedent. Words do drive actions. My own inclination is you try to police it by inviting people to be more mature and responsible rather than by arresting them. Trends change, people change. Menachem Begin, Nelson Mandela, Martin McGuinness, all referred to as terrorists, all seen later characterised as peacemakers. So there is hope. You don't extrapolate entirely from where we are now. On the media point, a final thing about the media. I mean, Alistair kindly mentioned I'm involved with Positive News. Part of the reason I think the Positive News appeals to our readers is it shines a light on all those millions and millions of good people who are out there doing good stuff and not getting covered, because it's completely obscured by whatever the latest photogenic tragedy is. If you look at something like the number of lives that will be saved by the malaria vaccine, which has had a fraction of the publicity of wars going on, if you look at the number of lives that have been saved in Bangladesh over the last 40 to 50 years by cyclone preparedness programs, which have cut typhoon deaths from the hundreds of thousands to a handful, that's had virtually no publicity. It's an amazing story. People don't know about it because the media doesn't always do its job of giving a fair reflection of what's going on in the world.
OK, thanks. Eve, the final word to you, but I just maybe within those words, a reflection on Martin's words precede actions, because in the blurb, I quoted someone from The Guardian who said, words of hate create an ethos of hate,
an atmosphere of hate, a political, social petri dish of hate, eventually spoken words become deeds. What's the relationship?
I think words do matter, because words can also undo hate. Words can also attack confusion, fear, division. They are our best weapon against hate. So the answer is not to stop words or stop bad words with nice words. Let's have that discussion, and that's the only way out of the problem. In fact, you know, we already have laws to stop the incitement of violence, which have been mentioned already. And it is the case that they worked. So this discussion around hate isn't because hate is on the increase. I mean, I think it's on the increase in very specific circumstances around the issue of anti-Semitism, as I've tried to argue. But the bigger overall context of this discussion is that there is an information war going on for the control of debate and discussion online, and that war, hate speech has become the weapon to fight that war by saying that people are hateful and dangerous, and the only way that we can go about life nowadays is to make speech safe and to cleanse our speech. And I think that that we have to turn that back on the people conducting this information war and say our speech isn't hateful, people are not hateful, people are great, and words are great, and that is our only way forward.
Can we thank the whole panel, please?